Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, just some very quick housekeeping. If you haven't seen, we released a special on the arrest of the Columbia University graduate student, former graduate student, so please check that out. If you haven't, like the pod, subscribe to the pod, rate the pod, and if you subscribe, please ask us questions in our Discord. We're doing weekly Q&A videos that are only on video where we talk. It's been, you know, kind of 40,000 foot questions, but I think they're pretty interesting. So check us out. Just Google American Prestige in YouTube and it'll come up. Okay, having done that, let's get into the news. Well, Derek, you know.
And subscribe to the YouTube channel too if you're not subscribed to that. That helps Derek us out as well.
Thing, so don't disappoint him. I just hate to see Derek disappointed. So don't disappoint him.
I appreciate that.
So let's start out. You know, Derek, we usually start out with bad news, but you know, this is kind of good news because everything is kind of going to hell, but at least we might all be dead soon. So let's talk about the sea ice hitting its lowest level ever recorded.
It's more space for people to go swimming. I mean, if the, you know, sea level,
that's pretty, sea ice, yeah, really pretty good. Miami, don't buy, you know, property
more,
in Miami.
More water to swim in, I guess. It doesn't raise the, This is ice on the sea, so it doesn't raise the water level, but it is more water as opposed to ice. So that's gotta be good for swimming. So there was a new report from the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service late last week that said basically global sea ice fell to a record low in February. They tracked this data. The sea ice coverage in the Arctic was 8% below average. It was the lowest level of sea ice coverage for the Arctic in February that they'd ever recorded. And sea ice in the Antarctic was at 26% below average. That was the fourth lowest monthly level ever recorded. So basically, yes, we are in what is probably a feedback loop. I mean, sea ice is white. It reflects solar radiation back into space. So when the planet warms and the sea ice melts, there's less of that happening, which means the planet warms faster. It's one of these loops that climate scientists often warn about and that the rest of the world basically ignores, or at least the people who are in charge of it ignore. And it seems like we are in a fairly bad place on this one. So yes, if you're interested in, you know, what's going to get us out of the current rut that we're in and make things worse, this would be one way that could happen.
Well, I'm not worried. I'm sure the Democrats will do something. Let's move on to, this is going to be pretty depressing. Let's move on to Syria and let's talk about the massacres against the Alawite people.
The Syrian security forces and allied groups that were fighting alongside, let's say, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham when it was a rebel group, or that fought in the Syrian National Army under Turkish supervision during the Syrian Civil War, engaged in what was effectively a days-long massacre in northwestern Syria. Starting Thursday through the weekend, it seems to have calmed down. Things seem to have calmed down over the last few days. But this began midweek, kind of Wednesday, Thursday, with a couple of apparent attacks by what the Syrian government has called pro-Assad militants. It's not quite clear what that entails, whether it's remnants of the old Syrian army or militias that were pro-government when Bashar al-Assad was in charge and are now anti-government. But there were a couple of attacks on Syrian security forces in Latakia, province. And that prompted a response from the government, which sent deployed security forces into the region. They came along with these groups that are not formally part of the Syrian security apparatus, but are still kind of hangers on with the ex-HTS fighters that comprise the bulk of the Syrian security forces now. And they went pretty wild, it sounds like, not just attacking, you know, not just going after these so-called pro-Assad militants, but pulling Alawite civilians out of their homes, men and boys in particular, executing them on the spot. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that at least, at last count, I saw 1,383 civilians were killed in this extensive campaign of violence. That figure may be out of date at this point. It's at least a day old. And they're, you know, still discovering sort of bodies and mass graves, that type of thing. So this was an orgy of violence that seems to have gone way beyond just responding to a couple of attacks and went into or, you know, dived into the sort of revenge killings, pogroms, you know, massacres that people have been warning about and afraid might happen to the Alawite community in particular, because Alawites, of course, that's the community of the Assad family. Not to say that Alawites had really, you know, ordinary Alawites had anything to do with that regime, but the fear has been that these jihadist groups and other kind of rebel prone to violence and prone to violent attacks on civilians, groups that have been, you know, now legitimized by the state to some degree, would engage in this sort of violence. And we've seen instances of it before, but not to this extent. So there have been, there was a lot of international criticism as the reports came out of how many people were killed. Ahmed Ashara, the interim president of Syria, has promised to investigate. I'm sure that'll be a thorough job, and to, you know, bring anybody found to have targeted civilians to justice. We'll have to see how that goes. But yeah, this is not a good sign if you're concerned about where things are heading in Syria.
And let's move on to talk about this deal with the Syrian Democratic Forces.
That was announced on Monday rather abruptly, and I think probably partly because of this, the massacres that took place over the previous few days. But Shara, the leader of the Syrian Democratic Forces, Maslam Abdi, announced that they had reached a deal that they on what they've been negotiating for a couple of months now, which was an agreement to bring the SDF into or underneath the umbrella of the new Syrian government. A lot of the terms seem not to be really have been fleshed out in this agreement, and there will be technical talks on how exactly this stuff is supposed to happen. But notably, and I think a lot of people have looked at this and suggested that Abdi maybe took advantage of Shara, who was reeling after the massacres, needed to make a statement, not just to the international community about his interest in keeping Syria together and not letting it descend into internecine violence, but also feeling like he needed to make a statement domestically about, you know, bringing stability to the country and not more chaos. There's nothing in the agreement that they reach that says that the Syrian Democratic Forces are going to be dissolved and incorporated, you know, individually as individual fighters into the Syrian army or the Syrian security apparatus, which was Shara's big demand. Like, he did not want to bring the SDF in wholesale. He wanted it to dissolve itself, and then the fighters would come in individually and be broken up into different units. The SDF and Abdi have been insisting on doing it the opposite way, having the SDF just come in wholesale as its own kind of unit within the Syrian security state. That's not in the deal either, I should say. Like, as I said, a lot of the technical details seem like they have yet to be worked out, but it does seem to be somewhat of a victory for Abdi and the SDF, particularly insofar as what they did agree to in very general terms does talk about Syrian Kurds as a native community in Syria, which is the first time, according to some of the people I've seen analyze this, is probably the first time that's ever been put in writing in a document in Syrian history. So that's a fairly big development from the Kurdish side, from the SDF side. But, you know, again, as I say, most of the details have to be worked out yet. And it seems like there's probably some variability here in terms of whether this will actually be implemented.
Let's talk about Israel and let's talk about its blockade of Gaza.
Yes, the Israeli government intensified its blockade of Gaza over the weekend. It cut electricity to the territory. Now, the Israelis don't supply a ton of electricity directly to Gaza, but taken in concert with the fact that they've already blocked any aid from coming into the territory again in an effort to force Hamas to agree to their extension of the current truce. That means generators, which supply the bulk of the electricity in Gaza, are going to start running out of fuel. So they're going to start running out of power. The electricity that Israel does provide went to the territory's main desalination facilities. So you're talking about fresh water potentially being affected. So this is just an escalation of the pressure campaign they've already started to try and get Hamas to drop its insistence on moving to phase two of the ceasefire agreement and instead agree to an extension for however many weeks of phase one. So that's all tied up in those negotiations.
What about this new compromise position that the United States has proposed?
Right. So the talks on what to do next are underway in Qatar. The Israelis have sent a delegation there. I don't think Hamas has a delegation. They deal more indirectly through the Egyptian and Qatari mediators. But the Israelis have a delegation there. And the Trump administration sent its Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, to Qatar this week. So they are, I think Witkoff has since moved on to Russia. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But Witkoff apparently did bring a proposal with him to extend the Gaza ceasefire for, I believe, still another 2 months. The idea is to get through the Passover holiday, which is kind of mid to late April at this point, right? So maybe only 1 month at this point. They've just been vamping for so long that it's cut down. It was initially a 2 month ceasefire or a 2 month extension. I'm not sure what the parameters are now, but Witkoff's original idea was that they would continue to suspend hostilities through Ramadan and Passover, and that would to signify that on the first day of the extension coming into place, they would Hamas would release about half of the hostages that it's still holding, or prisoners in some cases. These are soldiers. Now we're talking about POWs that they're holding in Gaza. That was, I think, 10 living prisoners and something like 18 to 20 bodies of prisoners who have died in the interim since the October 7th attacks. Now he's talking about a smaller exchange of prisoners, 5 living hostages and around 9 to 10 deceased hostages would be released on the first day. And then the idea is they use this extension period to finally negotiate this phase two of the agreement that they reached in January, which would involve a full ceasefire, eventually the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza militarily, and the release of all the remaining hostages or prisoners and a release of prisoners on the Israeli side as well. That would, the bulk of that would happen then at the end of this extension with a new deal in place. It would happen in one fell swoop kind of at that point when they transition to the new arrangement. There's some possibility that this could make headway. The talk, when Hamas rejected Witkoff's initial offer, there was some talk that their objection might not have been so much to the framework, because it would get it would continue the ceasefire through Ramadan, which is something that they would obviously prefer to do. But with the idea that they were going to have to give up half of the remaining prisoners in the first, on the first day, basically, of this extension, they were balking just in terms of numbers. So it's possible that reducing the number could appeal to them. The Israeli government has already supposedly given its its approval to the new position that Witkoff brought with him. But there's no indication yet from Hamas, which, as I said, this takes longer because they work through intermediaries rather than being directly at the table.
What about this Azerbaijan-Armenian peace deal? What's going on there?
This is something that was just announced on Thursday by both the Armenian foreign ministry and the Azerbaijani foreign ministry. There's no detail around it, but obviously people are familiar with the conflict between these two countries, the wars over Nagorno-Karabakh, the pressure that Azerbaijan has been putting on Armenia to agree to a deal that would not just whereby Armenia would not just give up any pretense of control over Nagorno-Karabakh, but would also give Azerbaijan rights, territorial rights, really, in the southern part of Armenia, connecting Azerbaijan proper to Nakhchivan, which is an exclave of Azerbaijan that is located on the other side of, basically the other side of Armenia. It's separated from Azerbaijan by Armenian territory. So they've been kind of back and forth on this for quite some time. And suddenly on Monday both countries announced that they're ready to sign some sort of an agreement. I don't know how detailed it is. I don't know what's in the agreement. Nothing like that has been released yet. The Azerbaijani statement was a little bit less effusive than the Armenian statement. They suggested that there are a number of things that have to be done before a signing can take place. One of them is that the Armenian government has to amend its constitution to excise any claims of sovereignty over Karabakh. I'm not sure what else might be in there if they're supposed to have an agreement in place on this corridor, this transport corridor that Azerbaijan wants. So again, a lot of vagueness here and a lot of room for things to potentially fall apart. But this is an interesting development, certainly, to have both countries confirm that they've apparently made some diplomatic progress. So, yeah, we'll just have to see how it goes.
Our old friend Duterte is not doing especially well. Derek, tell us what happened with him.
Yeah, this was fairly stunning. On Tuesday morning, Rodrigo Duterte returned to the Philippines from Hong Kong, where he'd been for some time, and he was arrested in the Manila airport. It turns out that the International Criminal Court, which has been investigating him for some time now over the war on drugs that he led, first as the mayor of Davao and then subsequently as president of the Philippines, in which thousands of people were extrajudicially killed, executed by Philippine police. And they Philippine police acknowledge killing, I think, something like 6,200 people. And unofficially, there are claims that the death toll went up into the, teens, maybe 20,000 or more killed, just kind of murdered by police, effectively, as part of this, so-called war on drugs. And the ICC has been investigating him for crimes against humanity related to that. And apparently by Tuesday had gotten to the point where it was able to issue an Interpol arrest warrant. And the Philippine government complied with it, picked him up at the airport. He had been kind of warning Duterte had been kind of issuing these statements from Hong Kong, I guess seeing the writing on the wall, saying he was ready to be arrested if that's what it would come to. I still thought it was a little surprising that they actually did this. With that said, I mean, Duterte and the current president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., hate each other. They've gotten their relationship has deteriorated so far that there was a point last year where Duterte threatened to basically lead a secessionist movement in Mindanao province against the Philippine government. Duterte's daughter, who's the vice president, she and Marcos had this alliance when they were elected. It was seen as an alliance between the Marcos and Duterte families. They're on such bad terms that she talked back in November publicly about hiring a hitman to assassinate Marcos. She's been impeached over those comments. She hasn't gone on trial. She hasn't had her trial yet in the Senate. So things have deteriorated really badly between these two people, or these two factions. And I think that may explain, it certainly, I think likely explains the willingness of the Philippine government to participate in the ICC's arrest or to affect the ICC's arrest of a former head of state. Otherwise, it would be pretty eyebrow raising. But in this case, it sort of makes some sense.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
I always like when great minds meet. So let's talk about this potential Trump-Xi summit in June.
The Wall Street Journal reported on this earlier this week that apparently U.S. and Chinese officials are discussing a potential summit between Trump and Xi in June. This is supposed to coincide with their birthdays. Their actually birthdays are actually one day apart. They're not the same age. They weren't born in the same year. But Trump's birthday is June 14th, and Xi's is June 15th. So I guess the idea is that they'll have a little joint birthday party to get their talks off on a promising note. What's yet to be decided is where this is going to be held. U.S.-Chinese relations are not good right now. They're not good, particularly most acutely because of the tariffs that Donald Trump has imposed on Chinese products. We're up to 20% now on Chinese products, and China has retaliated. They have not had any communication, as far as I know, not even a phone call or any kind of electronic communication to discuss these tariffs, despite a lot of speculation that there could be negotiations to settle whatever grievances Trump seems to have. They haven't talked, so they seem to be pretty much girded up for a trade war here. And the question is now, who's going to make the trip, or should one of them make the trip to the other's capital, which would look like a concession to the other one, and neither one of them wants to do that. So I guess they could find a neutral site, but I don't know how that's going to play out.
The crisis in South Sudan is worsening. Derek, what's going on?
The UN warned a few days ago about what it called an alarming regression in South Sudan's peace process. We talked about this last week. The president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, has been purging his government of anybody connected to his vice president and chief rival, Riek Machar. There was one point at which last week in which South Sudanese police or security forces had surrounded Machar's home in Juba. Nothing, as far as I know, came of that. The cause of this, which is we now have more information about what's been going on, the cause or the immediate cause, I guess, the tension between these two guys is the real cause. But the immediate trigger was an incident in which a militant group that calls itself the White Army, that's active in South Sudan's Upper Nile State, had begun attacking government forces. There were some relatively minor battles going on between the South Sudanese military and this group. Kiir has alleged a connection, and there probably is one. Machar denies it, but it's likely there's some link here between his faction in the government and this White Army militant group. On Friday, the militants apparently shot down a UN helicopter that was trying to evacuate a unit of South Sudanese soldiers from one of those battles. At least 27 soldiers and one UN worker were killed. So that just took things to a new level of tension, and it's been pretty steady there since then. The Ugandan government claimed earlier this week that it had dispatched special forces to Juba to protect Kiir, basically putting them at his disposal. South Sudanese officials have sort of denied that. They've said there's no Ugandan forces in Juba. I suspect they're trying to use some sort of technicality. Maybe they're not actually in Juba, but they're someplace else. But it does seem like this is as close to a full breakdown of the 2018 peace agreement that Kiir and Machar signed as we've seen since that deal, and could be the a precursor to a return to civil war, although Kiir insists he's not going to let things get that far.
So over in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the government might be making a deal with M23. Update us, Derek.
Yeah, it's possible. The Angolan government, which is sort of serving as the mediator between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and M23/Rwanda, which is the M23's main patron, of course, announced earlier this week that it's holding peace talks between the Congolese government and M23 that will take place next Tuesday, March 18th. This would be a pretty significant development if it actually happens. The Congolese government has heretofore steadfastly refused to negotiate directly with M23 because it insists that M23 is just a puppet of the Rwandan government. It's the Rwandans who are the real problem here, and so they will only negotiate directly with the Rwandans. So if these peace talks actually come to pass, the sheer fact of having Congolese and M23 negotiators sitting across a table from one another would be a pretty significant development. That said, the Congolese government says it's only considering the invitation to participate in these talks and has not made a decision yet. So it's possible that the Angolans got a little bit out over their skis in announcing this thing. It's unclear if it's actually going to happen. It certainly would be worth an attempt because negotiations, to the extent that there have been any between the DRC and Rwanda, have gotten nowhere. So maybe there's a possibility for some sort of development if M23 itself is at the table. But at this point, who knows?
Let's turn to Russia and Ukraine. And this is going to be frustrating because Putin is doing what one would expect one to do when they are winning a war. But let's start with the U.S.-Ukraine summit that has produced a ceasefire proposal and what that proposal is and how Putin's responding.
The U.S. and Ukraine sent representatives. Volodymyr Zelensky was there. The president of Ukraine, Marco Rubio, the secretary of state of the United States, were in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday for a summit to try and patch their relationship back together. And it really sounds like it went pretty well from the Ukrainian perspective. They came to an agreement on a 30-day potentially renewable immediate ceasefire in the Russian-Ukrainian war. The Ukrainians agreed to this. They had come offering a 30-day ceasefire at land and or at sea and in the air, not on land. But clearly, we're nudged to a full ceasefire by the United States. Their agreement resulted in the resumption or has resulted in the resumption of U.S. assistance to Ukraine. You may recall after their little dust up in the Oval Office a couple of weeks ago between Zelensky and Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, the Trump administration suspended military aid and intelligence support for the Ukrainian military. That has been turned back on, according to the Polish government verified that. That the aid is back in place, was back in place as of Wednesday, so just one day after this summit. What is as yet to be determined is whether the ceasefire is actually going to come off, because of course it takes two principals agree on a ceasefire. And as you say, Putin doesn't sound like he's terribly interested in a ceasefire right now, because he is in fact winning. He didn't outright reject the idea on Thursday when he finally commented on it. He, as you would expect, tried to massage it a little bit, suggested, we're definitely in support of a ceasefire in theory, but this needs more work. We need to see the details. We're not going to agree to anything, in the abstract. So he's pressing for probably some kind of concession. It's unclear what those concessions might be. He did mention concerns that Ukraine could use a 30-day ceasefire to rearm or mobilize forces. I think the Ukrainians would probably have the same concern about Russia, though. Although I guess the terms wouldn't apply to the Russians for some reason. So he did express some concern over that. But basically, I think he's waiting to hear more details from the United States before he makes any move. Now, Putin, as I said, Steve Witkoff, the Trump administration's Middle East envoy, I think is in Moscow now, or at least was supposed to arrive in Moscow on Thursday to sound Putin out about this, or sound the Russians out at least. It was unclear whether he was going to meet with Putin, and I haven't heard one way or the other. But I think for the Russians, they're in a little bit of a, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario at this point, because they are winning. A ceasefire would not be in their interest right now, especially with the situation in Kursk almost resolved. We could talk about that. But on the other hand, all of the, you know, the last couple of weeks that Putin has been reveling in the deterioration of the U.S.-Ukrainian relationship could flip on its head if he just flat out rejects this, if he alienates Trump in some way. The talk is that the Trump administration is prepared to impose new sanctions that would probably be more intense than any of the sanctions that the Biden administration imposed on the Russian energy sector. So that would really hit Moscow where it lives, so to speak. So he's got to be a little bit worried about that, although Russia has certainly weathered the past, you know, past U.S. sanctions pretty well. I think he's still got to take into consideration what kind of response he might get from Washington if he just says, no, we're not doing this.
Let's talk about Kursk and how Russia's doing there pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, as of Thursday, it looks like Russia has retaken pretty much the entirety of Kursk. There was a video that Russian media circulated on Wednesday showing Russian forces that appeared to show Russian forces in the town of Sudzha, which is the main border town that the Ukrainians seized when they entered Kursk in August and has been the center, kind of the hub of their occupation of Kursk since then. On Thursday, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had, in fact, regained full control of Sudzha, which means this is, for all intents and purposes, over. I think this operation to invade Russian territory and try to, you know, flip the tables on the Russians. I don't think the Ukrainians have withdrawn yet entirely from Kursk. But they should be, if they're not, you know, if that decision hasn't already been taken, I would say they probably should be considering it very heavily at this point. Without Sudzha, it's unclear, you know, how much of a stand they can make at this point. There's some, you know, it's unclear exactly how far this has gone. The Russians have even managed to flip this around and have invaded Sumy Oblast in Ukraine across the border, although they only have a small foothold at this point. But this could turn into a much bigger disaster. As we've talked about in the past, if the Ukrainians lose entire military units here, or if this turns into another beachhead for the Russians to invade Ukrainian territory, a serious one, this could turn out to be a real disaster. And it really does look like any chance of holding on to any territory here for in advance of peace talks is probably come to an end.
So Trump has been saying some wacky things, and if necessary, we'll do a special on them. But let's talk about one of the wacky things, which is that the United States might be invading Panama.
Well, we're not going to invade Panama. We're going to increase our military presence.
That's presently in Panama.
Yeah, it's a different thing. This is from NBC News, which reported it on Thursday, with a big exclusive banner at the top of the page. The report here is, I'll just read the first paragraph. The White House has directed the U.S. military to draw up options for increasing the American troop presence in Panama to achieve President Trump's goal of, quote unquote, reclaiming the Panama Canal, according to two U.S. officials familiar with the planning. Somehow that's not an invasion. I'm kind of at a loss as to how increasing your troop presence in order to seize part of another country is not an invasion, but they're making some distinction between this. And in fact, later in the piece, you're told, the NBC piece, that these sources are saying that a U.S. invasion is unlikely and would only come under serious consideration if a larger American military presence in Panama does not achieve President Trump's goal of reclaiming the Panama Canal. So again, I'm not really sure what the dividing line here is between what he's trying to do and an actual invasion, but they're trying to claim one. yeah, I don't have much more to say about this other than the fact that it's been reported. It is batshit, but so many things that come out of this administration are. I don't know how seriously to take it. If they're drawing up plans, that seems fairly serious, but we'll see.
Okay, Derek, let's talk about our neighbor to the north's new prime minister.
Right. As expected, the former governor of the Canadian Central Bank, Mark Carney, won the internal leadership election within the Liberal Party to replace outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who announced his resignation back in January. Carney won in a landslide. He took almost 86% of the vote. This was, again, an internal party election. He is supposed to replace Trudeau as prime minister in the next few days. I think I saw at one point Friday. I'm not sure if that's what they've decided on, but it could be as soon as Friday that he will actually succeed to the post of prime minister. He is going to immediately be confronted with another one of the batshit things that Donald Trump has said, which is that he would like to turn Canada into the 51st state of the United States. He'll also, on a less batshit note, be confronted with the tariffs that Trump keeps threatening to impose on Canadian goods and then rescinding, sending businesses, companies, markets into a furor and then kind of roiling them for no apparent reason. Also, he'll have to deal with, and we'll get to these in a moment, he'll have to deal with the new metals tariffs that Trump has imposed. So, all kinds of fun things that he's going to have to deal with. And we do have, there were reports in a couple of places, the New York Times for one, about the nature of this Canada annexation call that Trump keeps making. Apparently, in one call that he had with Justin Trudeau back in early February, which was part of the back and forth that eventually saw him rescind for a month the 25% tariffs that he had imposed on Canadian imports. Apparently, Trump told Trudeau that he believes that the treaty, the 1908 treaty that sort of finalized the international boundary between Canada and the United States, was invalid, and he wants to change the border. He didn't say how he wants to change the border or what he's looking for, what he's looking to grab. He has talked in the past about being unhappy with the way that the U.S. Shares the Great Lakes with Canada, rivers around the Great Lakes, the way those waterways are shared. So maybe he wants all the Great Lakes. I don't know. I don't pretend to understand any of this or how his brain works, but this is the kind of stuff that Carney is going to immediately have to deal with. And he's also staring into the teeth of an election later this year that the Liberals previously looked like they were going to be creamed by the Conservative Party, but because of the rise of nationalist sentiment, basically, or, you know, at least opposition to Donald Trump, and the fact that Trudeau has been the focus of that opposition, also his decision to resign. He was unpopular personally, but at any rate, whatever combination of Trump and Trudeau resigning have alchemically affected this race. The polling is now much closer. It looks like the Liberals might actually be able to hang on, although, you know, again, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
You mentioned the tariffs, Derek, but let's talk about them a bit more.
Trump, so there's two things to talk about here, which is the tariffs that he announced back in February on Mexican and Canadian products, 25% across the board, that he then rescinded for a month, were supposed to come into effect last week because the month that month's grace period had expired and he was supposedly unhappy with whatever the Mexican and Canadian governments had done to try to appease him. So they were supposed to come into effect last week. They did come into effect on March 4th. And then a couple of days later, he rescinded them again. He rescinded them on Thursday, again for another month. So we'll see what happens in April. The drop dead date now seems to be April 2nd. He's got this reciprocal tariff scheme that he wants to put in place where basically the U.S. will impose tariffs in the same amount that every other country in the world is imposing on U.S. imports. It will do, you know, some reciprocal action against what Trump considers to be unfair trade practices. That's supposed to come into effect on April 2nd. We'll see. You know, we'll see if he actually sticks to that one. But that seems to be the new date when everything's going to take effect. What did take effect this week and does not seem like he's inclined, at least right now, to do away with is his 25% tariffs on all foreign aluminum and steel products coming into the country. So we do have that new development. That sparked an array of responses from the major, you know, trade partners who export a lot of metals products to the United States. The EU, Canada, both announced immediate retaliatory tariff measures of their own. The Australian government said it's going to pass for now. The UK also said it's sort of keeping its options open, but it's not going to do anything immediately. Anyway, the markets are loving this. They're all still crashing and looking forward to this April date now, which we don't know what's going to happen because he's been so inconsistent about this, imposing and then revoking, and then some things stick and some things don't. It's all been kind of a mess.
Well, Derek, we started with good news. We all might be annihilated soon. And let's end with good news. It's always good to see someone you like land on their
feet. Also something that might cause us to be annihilated at some point. Yeah.
So tell us how friend of the pod Jake Sullivan is doing.
Well, Jake is looking good. He's been appointed to as the Henry Kissinger Professor of the Practice of Statecraft and World Order at the Kennedy School at Harvard. So I think, obviously, congratulations are in order. I think as the professor of war crimes, I guess this is like the seat for people who do war crimes. He's in good company. Obviously, he's a worthy successor to Kissinger. So congratulations to him and to Harvard, really. I mean, just this, you know, an awesome thing to have
a guy who should be
in the dock at The Hague. On another one, probably they probably got more, but it, you know, to lock this one up, I think, you know, congratulations to them.
Thank you everyone for listening. Really do like the pod, subscribe to the pod, join the Discord, ask us questions, and subscribe to the YouTube. We love you all, and as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye
bye.